Happy Monday and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. There's 85 days to go until the election. Well, 85 days until the election, and then another 78 days until Inauguration Day. So that's a total of 163 days that, frankly, none of us can really predict. Before we get started today, I just wanted to highlight something that I'm doing on my daily newsletter starting today. I started a countdown diary / journal, which is going to be a subjective account of what it's like to live through all of this. And, you know, I always thought that, I mean, when I was back in my 20s, I had an older mentor who said, Charlie, you really ought to keep a daily journal of what you're doing. I was entering into a challenging new job. And of course, I ignored his advice, which set a lifelong pattern of that sort of thing. But now I wish I had. Not because anyone else would be interested in reading it, but because I would be interested. You know, in particular, to remember what it's like to, you know, live history in real time. You know, the problem with histories, I mean, well, histories are valuable because they have more facts, they have more perspective, they can say this is what mattered, this is what doesn't matter, but they tend to impose a sort of coherence to events that did not actually exist. So the question that I've always had in my mind is, will historians be able to understand what we've gone through? I've been wondering this since 2017. So over the weekend, I actually read Elizabeth Drew's Washington Journal, which was her reporting of Watergate and Richard Nixon's downfall in real time. And she made that same point. She said, you know, she wondered about the historians and whether they would really understand what Watergate was like. Will they know how it felt to go through what we have gone through? Will they know how it felt to be stunned again and again as we learn what had been done by people in power? Will they know how it felt to be shocked, ashamed, and amused by the revelations? Will they understand the difficulty of sorting out the madcap from the macabre? Can they conceivably understand how it felt as we watched on our television screen our president say, "I am not a crook"? Well, I don't want to be misunderstood here, but, you know, it almost feels like Watergate was a gentler, more naive time because we actually had a news cycle about that back then. We had some semblance of guardrails. We could still be shocked by the idea that our president was a liar. So this is what I've set out to do, and you can check it out on our newsletter, Morning Shots. I'm just going to sort of record, okay, what am I thinking about today? What are the questions we don't know an answer to? So, for example, sitting here on August 10th, 2020, I don't honestly know, and nobody knows, are we headed toward this massive constitutional cataclysm after the election? Is it going to be a complete fiasco? Will it take weeks and weeks and weeks? Will we have a constitutional crisis? Or are we just hyping these fears? We just don't know what's going to happen right now. So the historians will sit back and they'll go, well, these were irrational fears. People didn't, you know, this is an indication of just how unhinged the politics was back in the summer of 2020. Or maybe historians will say, Americans were blithely, naively complacent about what was about to happen to them. So I don't know, but you can check it out on the newsletter. And one of the things I'm trying to capture is just how crazy this time is, just the swirl of events, all the things that happen that we have to process in a way that no one, I think, has ever had to process, at least in the volume and the pure craziness of it. I mean, you know, I read in there that, you know, you just think about just the last week. Before the weekend, you had the Manhattan District Attorney suggesting he's pursuing criminal charges against the President of the United States, and nobody remembers that story now. You know, Trump has this insane press conference on Friday night at his golf club, and it's already vanished from the what we consider the news cycles. Remember, it was last week, the president suggested that Joe Biden's election would hurt the Bible and hurt God. His administration actually shut down the census a month early, and we've already moved on. You know, so you open up the notes and, you know, you have Kanye West running for president with GOP support, Libertarian Party candidate gets bit by a bat, Jerry the Lesser, you know, done in by his undone zipper and his drunken phone call. And those are not the craziest things that are happening. You know, we make a list of the craziest things that are happening. The president of the United States apparently reaching out to the governor of South Dakota for the procedure to add himself to Mount Rushmore. And I'm not even sure that's on the top 10 list. You know, where do you start? you know, the president, you know, deconstructing the post office in order to sabotage mail-in voting, the new estimates that maybe 300,000 Americans might die by September if we don't start wearing masks. You have that weird interview with Attorney General Bill Barr saying that Democrats have become, this is his phrase, a Rousseauian revolutionary party that believes in tearing down the system, whatever that means. But the big story of the day is still people trying to figure out what the hell did the president do with those executive orders? The president issuing a series of executive orders, including most dramatically deferring the payroll tax. This is the payroll tax that pays for Social Security and Medicare. And the president ruling with a pen in the Constitution. And of course, one of the most interesting parts about that was watching all of the Republican constitutional conservatives step up and denounce this. But no, I'm kidding, of course. Ben Sasse issued a statement calling it unconstitutional slop. But my old friend Scott Walker moved seamlessly from small government constitutional conservative to pen and phone authoritarian because, I don't know, MAGA. He tweeted out, Congress can't get it done, so the president does. This is the sort of thing that will get Donald Trump reelected in 2020. Voters are tired of the crap in Washington. They want leaders who get things done. Whoa. So joining me on the podcast to sort all this out, our good friend Adam White from the American Enterprise Institute. So Scott Walker just basically going, voters are tired of this whole legislative constitutional balance powers crap in Washington.
Yeah, it sounded a lot like Obama's line, Congress won't act, therefore I will. I thought that was their line.
Well, that was their line, and that really is the declaration. I mean, this is the new this is apparently the new red line here. You write in National Review along with Yuval Levin that these executive actions offer little real relief but are constitutionally dangerous. And this whole premise that he can act because Congress doesn't pass something. You were right. It's a premise fundamentally at odds with the logic of our constitutional order, and it points to a number of dangerous dysfunctions in the American system of government that are now thoroughly bipartisan. I have to admit, there's part of me that looks at this and go, constitutional conservatism is just, this is the twilight. If Republicans give up on it like they are now, can't count on Democrats to embrace it.
Well, I think also the challenge here is remembering that the Constitution is more than just a legal document. I mean, of course, it is a legal document, and so much of the conversation around this is about the legal authority for doing this and that, and that's a deeper conversation. But sometimes we miss the forest for the trees, and we forget that the Constitution is also a basic charter for governance and embodying basic principles of how government should work, how it should do its business. And that was the point that Yuval and I were trying to raise in this piece at National Review, which was to remind people that whether or not these executive orders and memoranda are actually lawful, and they seem to be so gerrymandered around, rightly around some legal tripwires that they actually don't have much effect, even setting aside those legal discussions, just this basic question about how do you run a country and how should a president get the job done? Should he just sign some memoranda or should he actually try to build a political case and then get Congress to enact legislation that actually creates some certainty around these programs instead of the now astonishing uncertainty that will be created by this new tax policy? I think Bill Kristol made some eloquent points along these lines the last time he appeared on your podcast as well. We've got to ask ourselves, how are we running this country?
Yeah. Well, and what the standards are, whether or not you just change teams depending on who's in power. You made a point that I wanted to underline before we get into the constitutional questions. I know that Judd Legum wrote about this in his newsletter, that the president's orders really turn out to be far less than meets the eye. Trump did not extend federal unemployment benefits. He cut them. Trump did not impose an eviction moratorium of any kind. He just had a memorandum to think about it. Trump's payroll tax deferral is optional for employers, broadly opposed by members of both parties, and would provide negligible economic relief. It's not a cut. It's a deferral, which means that if there's not legislation, you would have to pay all that money back. So there's a lot questionable about this, but I guess it is the now the expectation that seems to be built into our American politics, and I think this is what you were talking about, that if you don't get what you want from Congress, you don't have to go through that procedure. You then look to the pen and phone president. And, you know, this is now bipartisan. And I just wonder, Republicans, one after, with the exception of Ben Sasse, lined up in favor of this. Do they not understand the precedent this is creating?
I mean, you'd think they would.
You would think.
It's funny to think back to the 2008 presidential election when Barack Obama campaigned against President Bush's use of executive power, said, you know, we're not going to do it that way. President Bush tried to do everything unilaterally. We won't do it that way. And then, of course, we know exactly what President Obama did. He took it up and dialed it to 11. And so, of course, then 4 years ago, as President Trump was campaigning, he was criticizing what President Obama had done with executive power, criticizing the use of executive orders. And now, obviously, he's governing quite differently. Of course, we can always expect a little bit of this, right? A part of the institutional part of our government is that people in office gravitate towards the use of the powers available to them. And executive power, the use of executive orders, either under the Constitution or under the countless statutes that over a century or more have delegated powers to the president, those become very, very attractive tools for a president. But our constitutional system also needs our president, especially, to exercise self-restraint. That's why we have a duty in the Constitution for the president to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. That's there because we know that presidents left to their own devices might not want to execute certain laws that they don't like. But when they become president, yes, they're involved in the legislative process, but they also have duties to carry out the law faithfully and not just sort of waive laws willy-nilly.
Okay, well, that raises the question of selective prosecution, because, of course, President Obama used this with DACA, leaving aside the policy issue, because I think that Congress should have acted on that first. But can the president just say, I am not going to enforce these laws, I'm not going to collect these taxes? Does he have that ability?
You know, it's funny, when President Obama said that he wasn't going to enforce the immigration laws against children and their parents, a policy which might well have been justifiable as a matter of legislation, Ted Cruz released a report, and he said something along the lines of, you know, those who are sitting idly by watching President Obama do this, what would you say if a Republican president were to just waive tax laws? And I think he meant that as sort of a bad thing at the time, right? As a parade of horrible. Now we just take it as a parade of wonderfuls and cheer on our president as he does this. As a constitutional matter, I know the president can't just waive these laws in perpetuity. The challenge, though, is that courts are often not well suited to adjudicate that kind of dispute. The courts are always very wary of telling the executive branch to do more to enforce the laws, because there's always some sort of enforcement discretion that's necessary given the limited resources that even the federal executive branch has. So courts are very, very wary of intervening. They really only intervene when there's a clear statutory mandate that the president must specially enforce this particular law. And so, as Yuval and I point out, it's not clear that the courts would intervene in cases like the ones President Trump is now teeing up. It's not clear that the courts should intervene in those cases. But that means for situations where the courts are ill-suited to intervene and we want judicial restraint, we need more assertion by the rest of our governing institutions and by the people themselves.
But what if you have, so you're talking about the House and the Senate. So if you have a Republican majority that is going to go along with this, then aren't you suggesting that there really is no check on this? other than, of course, the election.
Yeah, I mean, I'd steer clear of saying no check, right? Even individual members of Congress, if collectively they're not going to do anything, individual members of Congress can speak out, can side with Democrats in calling for investigations and oversight. I'd say within the executive branch, yes, the president's in control of the executive branch and his word probably should be final. But the founding fathers, especially Alexander Hamilton in his writings in The Federalist, made clear that we don't want an executive branch full of people who just simply salute whatever the president is sending up the flagpole. And there needs to be at least some constructive feedback and pushback within the executive branch before decisions are made. And so I'd say people within the executive branch have a real obligation here to try to elevate these issues back up to the White House, try to steer the White House away from ever more reckless assertions of executive power. And so then there's that. There's also the states.
Okay, I want to read you this. This is the executive memorandum on his order on providing the unemployment benefits. Just want to read the language here. Because many of the relief programs created by the Congress have expired or will shortly expire, my administration and the Republican leadership in the United States Senate have proposed multiple options to continue to provide needed relief to Americans. But Democratic members of Congress have twice blocked temporary extensions of supplemental employment benefits. Political games that harm American lives are unacceptable, especially during a global pandemic, and therefore I am taking action to provide financial security to Americans. So he's really basically saying, I mean, just, you know, that I'm going to do Congress's job for it.
Yeah, that's right. That's, as we read that, it reminds me, I think it was Mario Cuomo who once said that we campaign in poetry, but we govern in prose, reminding us that there's a difference between the sort of rhetoric that's used in political campaigning and the sorts of actual explanation and justification that's required in governance. And we've totally erased that line now. These documents, they're assertions of executive power, but they're just basically campaign documents. And there's really no line dividing those two aspects of political governance.
Yeah, you described this as, you know, having quoted this in your article with Yuval, that this is an administration, this is an admission of constitutional impropriety. Now, okay, if that's the case, why wouldn't a judge look at that and say, no, this is my job is to adjudicate these questions of constitutional power, of separation of powers. And clearly, you are right here in black and white are admitting that you are stepping into the areas that the Constitution and Article One has given to the Congress.
Well, because we can recognize what these basic categories of legislative power and executive power are. We understand that they're different and that the government should act differently in the process of making law versus enforcing law. But the fact is, as a legal matter, sometimes these things blend into each other, right? Statutes on the books, the ones that are cited by the memoranda and executive order that President Trump sent out on Friday, there are sometimes plausible justifications for doing things like, I mean, in the tax case, you know, deferring the payroll tax, mm-hmm. or like these other things. And precisely because these executive actions, setting aside the tax one, really do sort of very little on their own. They're mostly calls for action by states or by the administration or by employers and so on. There's very little there. But what Yuval and I were getting at is what the president's trying to do here is to force a policy change. I mean, I keep bringing it back to the tax one, but because in some ways that's just the most astonishing. He knows he can't waive people's taxes, although he'll talk, I'm sure for the months to come, he'll talk about how he cut their payroll tax.
Sure.
But all he's done is he's deferred them. He's allowing the people, and it's limited to people whose biweekly pay period is generally less than $4,000 on a pre-tax basis. He's taking these people and basically allowing their payroll taxes to be treated like a credit card. They're going to ring up a giant tax bill, and then right around Christmas, right through December 31st, people are going to have to look at Congress and say, wait, are you actually going to make the people pay these taxes now? And so President Trump is basically, you know, I don't want to say threatening, but he's playing a game of chicken.
Yeah.
With people's tax bills. Again, it comes down to a style and a character of governance. How are we going to do this? Are we going to actually do the hard work of persuasion and try to make legislation? Or we're just going to walk away. You know, one of the funny things about that ad that's floating around now, recounting all of President Trump's statements on the campaign trail, he said, you know, President Obama couldn't convince people to do anything, so he just did. He got tired of trying, and he just did executive orders. Right? Well, and President Trump was making the exact case against Obama's pen and phone constitutionalism that all and I are trying to make now.
Okay, so Adam, since you mentioned that, let's play. This is put together by the Lincoln Project, but I think what makes it so devastating is that it is just Donald Trump's words. This is what he said when he was running for president, and keep in mind in the contrast between what candidate Trump said, which was the, I think, you know, rather, believe it or not, even by Trumpian standards, rather conventional conservative Republican position before 2016 versus where we are today. Let's play it.
Signing executive orders is not the way our country was supposed to be run.
Nobody ever heard of an executive order. Then all of a sudden Obama, because he couldn't get anybody to agree with him, he starts signing them like they're butter.
You have a president that signs executive orders because he can't get anything done.
He signs on immigration and on other things.
I want to not use too many executive orders, folks.
The executive orders are an outrage. We have a president that can't lead. He said, the hell with it. I'm not going to do this anymore. I want to rest and I want to do other things, including going out play golf. This guy played hundreds of rounds of golf.
First of all, what would he signed them like butter?
I'm still scratching my head. I'm just amazed Trump didn't throw in a like a dog like he always does. You know, he signed it like a dog.
Yeah, he sort of has like Mad Lib, you know, phrases that he would use. But I'm not sure why a butter. I mean, you cut through something like a knife through butter. I don't think you sign things like butter. But that's pretty stark. His rejection of the executive orders, and rather remarkably, he explains why it's a bad idea, as you point out.
Yeah, that's right. And again, President Obama did something very similar in his campaign, and I suspect Joe Biden will do something very similar in the months ahead, and then govern very differently. The thing is, I want to be very clear here, there's a good and important place for executive orders in constitutional government. I've written about this many, many times over the years, that executive orders can be very useful in helping to drive an administrative process, and that they shouldn't be undervalued. They should be used properly. But President Trump, what he's doing here is sort of the worst of both worlds. He's not really ordering much of anything that's within his power to order, and he's using it as a substitute for a real meaningful legislative process. You know, President Obama liked to say, and Trump is now basically saying, Congress won't act, therefore I will. The problem is the relationship really runs the other way. It's precisely because presidents can and will act unilaterally that's why Congress won't act. If you're a Republican in Congress, why would you ever try to work on legislation, make the compromises you're going to need? Because you're going to get primaried if you try to make compromises. If you're the out-of-power party, if you're in the Democrats right now, why would you try to compromise towards any of these things? So everybody just kind of puts their views on the table, and then they sit around and wait for the president to just take action. This is what happened in the border wall construction funding debates from, what was it, early 2019, I think. Maybe 2018, the time flies. but over and over again, this is the dynamic that we get on things like this, that Congress just sort of, the members of Congress put out their policy views, and then we just wait to see what the president's going to do. It's totally backwards.
I'm having a hard time understanding the whole tax deferral issue. Leaving aside the legal issue, the politics of it is pretty awful. And there's a reason why Republicans in Congress were telling Trump, no, that's not the answer. I mean, number one, first of all, of all of the urgent needs we have right now, cutting the taxes of people who are still employed is not at the top of the list. You only pay the payroll tax if you have a job and are employed. This does nothing for people who are unemployed. It does nothing for businesses that are going under. It doesn't do anything to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. It doesn't help state governments. It doesn't help hospitals. It doesn't do any of those things. Okay, so it seems disconnected with the actual nature of the economic crisis. That's number one. Number two, this is the payroll tax that funds Social Security and Medicare. So having not solved the problem, he walks into what has to be the easiest layup for the Democrats, who love running, accusing Republicans of threatening Social Security and Medicare, even when they're not. But in this particular case, you are, at a crucial moment, draining the resources of Social Security and Medicare. And I got an email yesterday from a guy saying, hey, I don't know if you can answer this question, but I'm on Social Security. Should I be worried about my Social Security payments because of this? I think the answer is no, but that tells you the political downside of this. So I am trying to get inside Donald Trump's lizard brain, what he thinks he's doing. Maybe he thinks he's springing some sort of a tax trap on Joe Biden, but I'm guessing the Biden campaign is not seeing it that way.
Yeah, it's inexplicable to me too. I can see some benefit if you're in a two-income family and one of you has lost the job. It's good that the other person's payroll taxes are not being collected for the time being. Like, I get that, but of course, the most direct course to fixing the unemployment problem is just greater unemployment benefits. But the broader problem that you've identified, this great uncertainty, I really think we ought to focus on that in and of itself. And I keep bringing this back to the founding fathers and Hamilton. But the whole point of executive power and an energetic executive was what Hamilton called steady administration of the laws.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, key. Not just energetic administration, but steady administration. We need a system of government where people can plan their lives around it. I mean, laws change, right? But we have a legislative process for that. Once the law has been settled, people need to be able to organize their lives accordingly. The kind of actions President Trump took last week are the opposite of that. We're sitting here right now. We have no idea what this really means in practice. I mean, yes, these people won't have their payroll taxes collected, but do they know whether they're going to have a huge tax bill on December 31st? I mean, probably Congress will probably, their hand will be forced. They'll have to fix it, but who knows? And so this just inserts this immense uncertainty about what all of this means.
Well, that's why I wonder how employers are going to handle this, because of course the payroll tax has two parts to it, right? I mean, it has the portion paid by the, is it still 6.2%? I'm sorry, I should look this up, but.
Yeah, I think it's 6.2.
Yeah, 6.2% paid for by the employee, and then the same amount paid for by the employer. So there has to be a decision made by the payroll department. Do you continue to withhold it? What do businesses do? Are they going to be banking their portion of that tax? It is a strange moment. It is a strange moment, but you do feel that the president right now is flailing around. And the, you know, every, and I've said this before on the podcast, every day that passes, you know, closes the window for him to make some pivot. I think he sort of imagined that this executive action was a pivot and all of his folks, this is strong leadership. This is the president stepping up. But I think this is one of those moments where the closer people look at it, the less is there. The other big issue, I don't know how you feel about all of this, is I'm watching the reports about, you know, going back to school. And I am really sympathetic for people who want kids back in school. But it seems so chaotic right now. There are so many things that can go wrong. And it doesn't appear that there's any sort of a coherent plan nationally for doing all of this. You know what? Okay, so my gut sense is, if I had to, you know, lay down my marker on August 10th, 2020, which apparently I do, I think this is going to be a huge fiasco. And unfortunately, it's going to fall very heavily on families who've already been tremendously stressed by this year.
Yeah, you know, we have kids, not you and me, Charlie, but yeah. my wife and together. My wife and I have kids. Our oldest is in high school, and our youngest is going into kindergarten. So we're seeing sort of the whole range of grades and this, and our school district began with sort of a hybrid idea, and now we've gone to starting the year all virtual. And it's been a challenge for us. Of course, I'm an academic, and my job can be done out of the home, and my wife can be home as well. And so for us, the impacts of it are muted. For our friends who are both working, who have couples who are both working out of the home, I just don't know how they deal with it. And again, it's just the radical uncertainty of it, of not knowing where this is going to be. Now, of course, the uncertainty comes first and foremost from the virus, which our government has not been able to, you know, wrangle under control. And I think the time that we've wasted over the last now 6 months failing to actually come up with a regime that could get this under control has been just a catastrophe. But yeah, the people themselves are going to suffer the consequences, not knowing week to week, month to month, what things are going to look like. And even the families that are going back to school in the weeks ahead don't know whether they'll all be sent home before Labor Day or before Columbus Day. It's going to be just constant white knuckle flying through life until we get some certainty about how to treat this virus.
That's actually a good way of putting it. And this is one of the reasons I'm going back, why I wanted to start keeping a daily journal on all of this, because I'm not sure that people outside of 2020 are going to realize what a white knuckle experience all of this is. You know, the phrase that I hear from people more and more and more, and it's across the political spectrum: I don't know what to believe anymore. I don't know who to believe anymore. And I think that adds to the anxiety and to the confusion. So you have the president of the United States last week saying completely falsely that children were immune from the coronavirus, that they wouldn't get it. Well, now we have, what is the latest report? You know, tens of thousands of young people who are testing positive. Now, they may not die, but they may infect others. So we don't know. We had that story out of Georgia where everybody, all the kids showed up. Nobody was wearing masks. Did you follow that story? Some kid took a picture of all of the people in the hall. It went viral. The school's reaction was to suspend the student, which I thought was amazing because it made them look bad. They backed off from suspending the student. But today we're finding out that 9 students from that high school have tested positive for the pandemic, a big surprise. So again, you're going to have this back and forth, white knuckle experience. Is this information accurate? The president of the United States has become a vector of disinformation, which is just an extraordinary moment in our history. And you hope that the information is valid. But over the weekend, we got these reports about the pressure that's being put on Dr. Fauci, the pressure that's being put on Dr. Birx. You have to stay with the party line. Don't contradict the president. And man, if there's any time when we want to get reliable information, it is right now.
Yeah, something's gone profoundly wrong in American education over a course of generations, where people are not able to really grapple seriously with sources of information. You'd think that between liberal arts educations and STEM, our Americans would be extremely well suited to think hard about conflicting sources of information and sort out for themselves what the right answers are. But instead, we get something very different. It's like, I don't know, I'm writing a piece about this and I'm trying to grapple with it myself, but it's as though the American people, myself included, we take truth and information as to be something that somebody's just going to give us and we should just passively wait for it to arrive. And so when you get competing sources of information, right, one side telling you X and the other side telling you Y, somehow we all either become helpless and passive, or we just sort of passively take the side that lines up with our politics. We've just become completely unable to really grapple with these things for ourselves and try to make wise judgments about what the best sources of information are and to really think hard about them on an ongoing basis. Truth and information have become that sort of thing that just we expect to be imposed upon us or handed to us without actual active work on our own part. And I'm not sure where that comes from. I'm not sure what it means. And we're seeing it now wrapped up in the debates around everything from education and political correctness and cancel culture to the debates over Google and Facebook and Twitter. But there's just something's gone profoundly wrong with how we understand information and our own roles in understanding information.
Okay, I want to agree with you and disagree with you. Although I agree that something's gone profoundly wrong, but let me agree with you about the something has gone wrong in terms of our education and the ability for people to engage in critical thinking, because it's one thing that we have a flood of disinformation, false information, and hoaxes. That's one thing. That's the supply. But it's amazing how many Americans turn out to be gullible or unable to see through this or indifferent to whether or not something is truth. That's profoundly disturbing because we've always had lies out there. But now we have this mass flood of lies, but a lot of Americans who can't distinguish between what's true and what's false, the failure of civics education, the failure of history, you know, the education of in history, and of course the just basic, you know, how do you evaluate evidence in terms of science and everything? We've failed badly there. On the other hand, Adam, I don't know about you, but there's a point where I go, I am never going to be able to figure this out. That's why I need to have trusted folks. I get on an airplane. I can't tell you how to fix the airplane, how to fly the airplane. I have to trust the experts. I'm talking to you on a computer. I know how to turn it on and do various things, but if it started smoking, I would not be able to fix it. I am not an expert. I'm not an epidemiologist. So therefore, I have to have people who I trust, who will tell me things that I do not know and never expect to actually know. So we've also had the corruption in who do we trust? What is our attitude toward experts? Are we willing to say, you know what? When I got on that airplane, I have to trust the pilot. When I go into the hospital, I'm going to have to rely on the medical experts here. So something's broken there too, as well. Not just our educational system, but our just the system of received knowledge and trust.
Oh, I'd agree with all of that completely. You know, we don't sort of begin the world anew every day, rethinking everything from scratch. We'd all be paralyzed by choice and doubt and so on. All I'm saying is that when it comes to trying to figure out how to live our own lives and how to think through governance decisions at the local level, things like schools and so on, there has to be a way for us to make decisions under uncertainty, to look at trusted experts, but also to see the limits of the advice they're giving and the trade-offs between conflicting kinds of advice, economic advice versus public health advice and so on. And as citizens, try to digest these things ourselves, understand to some extent what kind of trade-offs we're talking about. I'm not saying everybody needs to be an expert in everything, and I'm not saying that expertise doesn't exist, but it's this lack of active effort on our own parts to identify experts and to think hard about what they're really advising and what the limits of their advice are.
And then, of course, fold into that, and I do feel like it's a broken record now, is the tendency of Americans to choose the experts they listen to based on their tribal alliances. So it is easier to sort of, you know, slide into that warm, safe bath of this is what my team is saying and what I'm expected to believe versus challenging it, because it is hard to break. I mean, if you watch Fox News 24/7, you listen to Rush Limbaugh, you listen to Mark Levin, you know, you're going to get a completely different view of what the science is telling you versus if you listen to somebody else. And I think that that's hard to break away from. So you have all the things we're talking about, and then the overlay of, you know, cultural identity. And then this is all taking place in the middle of a presidential election. So that's the mind-blowing part of this, is that all of this stuff is happening at the same time. And I think that adds to this sense of anxiety. Okay, so let me bounce something off of you. And you're somewhat younger than me. I was thinking back to previous elections. And, you know, I think a lot of people are haunted by 2016, legitimately so. And people keep bringing up things like, you know, well, what about 1988 when Michael Dukakis was so far ahead? What I remember back then was that politics was not so all-consuming. I mean, I'm a political nerd. I paid attention to it, but it was the kind of thing that it wasn't dominating. It didn't create this low-level buzzing anxiety in everything we did. I mean, you understand the point I'm trying to make here? Is there seems to be something sort of all-consuming about this now that really, even in some of our most contentious elections that we thought were so contentious, didn't exist then. 1996, everybody knew that Bill Clinton was going to beat Bob Dole, right? I mean, it was like, okay, you could be unhappy about it, but, you know, it wasn't the end of the world. You know, people didn't, you know, change their lifestyle as a result of all of that. Even in 2008, we were in the middle of this massive economic crisis. I think people understood who was going to be elected president. John McCain was prepared to lose. He was going to lose. You know, Bob Dole knew he was going to lose. He was prepared to lose. 2000, as bad as that was, Al Gore stood up and said, hey, I'm not going to put my country through all of this. I'm going to go. I will concede the election. This feels completely different than that.
I think that's right. There's always a risk in assuming that everybody is watching politics as obsessively as you and I and others, you know, sort of in our orbit do. There's surely a lot of people who aren't paying a whole lot of attention to this, and But yeah, I'd say you're right that there are more people who are more wrapped up in day-to-day politics and treating it as some sort of combination of a substitute for religion and a substitute for like a sports fan, a sports team allegiance, just sort of wrapping everything up in it. There is something unhealthy about that. I agree.
No, there is something unhealthy about it. And you hope that the long national nightmare will be over. I was watching some of the videos of Richard Nixon's resignation because I realized that while I was reading the Washington Journal by Elizabeth Drew, that it was the anniversary. It was August 8th, 1974, that the president resigned. And what a cataclysmic event that was. But try to imagine Watergate today with Twitter. Try to imagine and cable channels and websites and all of those things. They thought that was intense. They have nothing on us.
You know, something that just occurred to me as you sort of thought as you were explaining how all this is coming together. You know, we were talking about that executive order, the memorandum on the payroll tax, and how they're just pushing everything down. They've pushed it back to the end of this year, which means that if Joe Biden wins the election, that whole fight is going to come to a head in the middle of a presidential transition and just making a bad situation even worse.
Oh, well, see, that's what I'm kind of worried about when I think about the, you know, 85 days until the election plus 78. We really have 163 days. I don't know about you. I try not to listen to the Cassandras, the people who have the worst case scenarios. But I have to tell you, I was reading over the weekend, and I don't know whether you have seen this as well, this report by this nonpartisan organization that worked through some scenarios after the election, getting from November to January, and they did some war gaming. And what they concluded, what is this thing called? It's like the Transition Integrity Project. And basically, short of a landslide victory for Joe Biden, we may be headed for a severe constitutional crisis, you know, including violence and all of these things. It's just like you want it to be over on November 3rd, but it may be hanging fire through December. And so that's why people are looking at dates like, so we actually count the electoral votes on what day? States have to certify the electoral votes by what day? What happens if there is a dispute that runs past that date? And given some of the problems that could come with mail-in balloting, we just don't know. I mean, if it's anything like New York, what has it been, 7 weeks since they had a New York primary and we still don't have all the ballots counted?
Yeah, I remember a long, long time ago during the first days of the global war on terror, Dick Cheney said, you know, if there's a 1% chance of a terrorist attack happening, we need to treat it as a certainty. That's what these sorts of debates feel like to me, that everybody is sort of wargaming out what could go wrong in December, November, December, January, and then almost preparing for it as if it were a certainty. And so I have to admit, I've tried not to think much about this. I mean, who knows if Trump, you know, first of all, Trump might win. Second of all, if Trump loses, he could just go totally inert, right? Focus on pardons and just lose interest in governance. And there's real danger in that from a geopolitical standpoint. If you have an inert president for presidency for 2 months or for 3 months. So there's that as well. It's just, there's just so much radical uncertainty about what a Trump to Biden transition would look like that I guess we'll just cross that bridge if we get to
it. Well, see, that's where I think you do the risk reward, and the risk of being too alarmist is, I think, less than the risk of being complacent. Let me explain that. Is that you should be, if in fact we are about to go into a constitutional crisis and a huge fiasco, we really ought to know that, because if we don't get that right, the damage could be permanent. So if in fact there is too much heavy breathing about this is bad, and it turns out to be pretty much okay, well, then some of us will be embarrassed. There'll be overstatements of, you know, people will laugh about it. But if we make the other mistake, if we go to complete complacency and are unprepared for that, then that is potentially disastrous. And that's going to do real damage for a very, very long time. So I guess I lean to what you were referring to is the, you know, just if you're going to prepare for it, just at least have in your mind what you do in the worst case scenarios, because that seems more responsible to me.
Sure, we just want to make sure that the preparations don't become sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, I mean, then the example of the worst alarmism was Y2K. Do you remember Y2K?
Yes, I do.
which is now a punchline.
Yeah.
I will admit that I never got caught up in that. I always thought, I don't know what I based it on, but I always thought that was overhyped. And remember the stories about all the things that were going to happen and people spend billions of dollars and it turned out to be absolutely nothing. Now someone's going to write me, it wasn't absolutely nothing. It was this, and it was that, and it was pretty much absolutely nothing. So maybe we'll get lucky, and maybe it will turn out that this voting goes through, that people are all freaked out about it, and everything will go through. But I wouldn't bet my country on it, which is apparently what we have to do. So here's the thing, Adam. In Wisconsin, we have a primary tomorrow, our primary election, August 11th. And After our last fiasco, I did get the absentee ballot, and I did fill it out, but because life is life and there's nothing really on the ballot for it, I didn't turn it in. So now I got it tomorrow. I got to decide: do I actually vote? Do we just turn in the absentee ballot, drop it off at the drop box? There's nothing on the ballot that I care about or that's of any interest whatsoever. But I just want to make sure that it works. I just want to make sure that my vote is counted, because that's kind of, I've kind of become obsessed with that, that I just don't want to get caught up in some of this, you know, bureaucratic mail bullshit and everything and not have my vote count. And I'm guessing that other people feel the same way, that you know, part of the anxiety about this, it will focus attention on how to not get it wrong, how not to be screwed out of your vote, because the story that it may, and again, it may be exaggerated. I just don't know. I'm not in a position to know right now, but it certainly looks like Trump's cronies are messing with the Postal Service, and that they're messing with the Postal Service at the exact moment when the U.S. Postal Service is going to play a crucial role in a presidential election. And the president is obviously obsessed with mail-in voting. But this is one of those stories where you go, you're tempted to say, there's no way. The president is not going to mess with the post office, you know, at this particular moment. The president is not going to make it harder for Americans to vote. And you know what, Adam? He just damn well might.
He might, but, and also just the mere fact that we have to worry about basic competence, even setting aside, a conspiracy, just the thing that worrying about basic competence is sort of a sad enough commentary that we can't take that basic blocking and tackling for granted.
Exactly. Adam Wine, thank you so much for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast again today and sorting all of this out. We always appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Charlie. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.